I'd like to call this meeting to order. This is the Alaska Senate Resources Committee. Today's date is March 31st, 2010. The time is 3:30. We have a committee consisting of Senators Huggins, Stevens, Wagner, French, and myself, Wolakowski. Today we have an ambitious agenda. We have extended the time of our meeting until 5:30 to try to work our way through this. We have five bills before us that we'll take up in the following order. Senate Bill 255 regarding fish processor fees, licenses, and records by Senator Olson. House Bill 162 regarding creation of the Southeast State Forest. This is a governor's bill. Senate Bill 309 regarding gas exploration and development tax credits by the Senate Rules Committee. Senate Bill 290 regarding tax credit to drill wells in Cook Inlet by Senator Wagner. House Bill 280 regarding natural gas storage and taxes by Representative Hawker. It is our hope that we can move the first two of these bills today. We've had hearings on them. The other three bills will have their first hearing today, and it's the committee's policy to hear and hold bills to give members and the public an opportunity to provide additional input. We'll start out by taking up Senate Bill 255. This is a bill we heard on Monday. It would enable fisheries that have elected to pursue a permit buyback program to do so. The purpose of this, of course, is to stabilize the fleet and ensure the long-term economic stability of the fishery. This bill creates the legal mechanisms to ensure the proper accounting of all the transactions involved in this process. I see we have the bill sponsor, Senator Olson, with us, and your staff member, Mr. Benintendi. Senator Olson, would you care to make any comments to the committee before we discuss the bill?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is Donald Olson, the senator from Nome, who is the prime sponsor of Senate Bill 255. I just want to thank you very much for this opportunity to go ahead and address you. I know my staff member, Tim Benintendi, has been the main driving force behind all the technical work that's gone on, as well as the other staff from other concerned entities that are out there. I just thank you for hearing it. Thank you for the willingness to go ahead and move it out. And I think without this bill, this bill certainly strengthens the viability of the fisheries, even though it's fairly simple on its face. It's one of those things that does have some depth to it. And with that, I thank you.
Great, thank you. Any questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none. We also have a letter of intent to accompany Senate Bill 255. I have signatures of six of the seven members, and the one member who's not here will be hearing the bill in the next committee. And this agreement is based on an agreement between the seiners and the processors, and that the permit buyback program will not remove more permits than necessary for the health and viability of the fishery. That number has been set at 260 permits, and that's what our letter of intent says, and we're hoping to move that forward along with the bill as well. So is there any committee discussion on the bill? Is there a motion on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to move that Senate Bill 255 be passed out of this committee on to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
And including the letter of intent?
And including the letter of intent, yes.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, hearing none, the bill is moved. Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Okay, while my Michelle's getting ready to pass out the sign, the sheet, please make sure everyone signs that. Let's get call up House Bill 162, Southeast State Forest. We heard resounding public support for this bill on Monday. It would establish a new Southeast State Forest on about 25,000 acres of state lands presently used for timber harvest. Establishment of a forest will enable the Division of Forestry to manage these lands for a long-term supply of timber for local processors. Lands in the forest would also continue to be open for multiple uses. We have two small conceptual amendments for the bill regarding date changes. And the first, if I could direct everyone's attention to page 6, line 9, from July 1, the proposed conceptual amendment would be, and just so the committee members know, there was just a mix-up, and we had ordered a CS, and we actually got a CS to the Senate bill as opposed to the House bill. So if the committee's willing to move it with two minor conceptual amendments, then I certainly wouldn't have a problem with that. The first is to change the date on page 6, line 9, from July 1, 2009 to July 1, 2010. The second would be to make the same change to line 11. And the bill was introduced last year, and these effective dates no longer apply. We have Chris Mache, State Forester, on the line. Mr. Mache, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm present.
Okay, any last comments? Did I appropriately represent the proposed conceptual amendment?
Yes, you did. Those are the two changes that need to be made that would simply be corrections to the dates as you described. And if there's any other questions or comments, I'd be happy to try and answer those for you.
Any questions for Mr. Mache? Yes, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Chris, Charlie Huggins here. I remember when we did the university lands bill, and suddenly there were a lot of communities came out and said they never heard of this before, and there wasn't any staffing. Are we going to hear from communities that they were surprised by this or have concerns that weren't able to voice?
Through the chair to Senator Huggins, no, I don't believe you will hear that. We've spent a lot of time in Southeast Alaska. As I mentioned on Monday, I've spoken before both Southeast Conference and Tongass Futures Roundtable on several occasions, which have a wide representation of members and communities present in those bodies. And I've also spoken directly with a number of the communities, especially the ones closest to many of the units that are described in the legislation. So I do not believe you'll hear upwelling from communities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Good question. I asked a similar question yesterday and talked a little bit about the process that they went through. And the bill has another referral to finance, and so I would expect that if there are concerns, they'll be raised there. So I guess I would make the conceptual amendment to change line 9, 2009 to 2010 on page 6, and also on page 6, July 1, 2009 to July 1, 2010. Is there an objection to that conceptual amendment? Okay, hearing none. The amendment is adopted. Any committee discussion on the bill? Is there a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to move that we pass HB 162 out of this committee onto the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
As amended, Senator?
As French. Amended.
And we're joined by Senator Stedman. Senator Stedman, there's a motion on the table to move House Bill 162. We just did a conceptual amendment to change the effective dates from 2009 to 2010. I know this is a bill that's of particular importance to you. Did you have any comments or questions or anything you'd like to say at this point?
Mr. Chairman, this should include the entire Tongass National Forest, but I'll accept that the bill is presented here.
Mr. Chairman, my motion didn't state that. Just so we're all clear.
Mr. Chairman, I'll vote for that motion if it's an amendment to the bill.
We have a little problem here.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Stone. The motion is to move the bill as amended conceptually. Is there an objection to the motion? Okay, hearing none, the bill moves out of committee. Okay, next up we have we're going to start with a brief overview. We have several bills dealing with Cook Inlet, gas development incentives, and I should note that because of our time constraints, we'll need to limit. We're going to have a brief overview on Cook Inlet by Deputy Commissioner Marcia Davis from the Department of Revenue and Kevin Banks, Director of Division of Oil and Gas. And I would ask that they limit their testimony to 30 minutes. And with that, I'd like to call up Mr. Banks and Ms. Davis. Welcome to the committee.
I think we're waiting on Ms. Davis, who is picking up some materials that she left at her office. I would actually prefer if you'd give us a few minutes to get ourselves organized so that we make the presentation, but I can speak to some of these credits.
Why don't we try to get started, and then when she gets here, we can jump in, just because we have a very tight schedule, and I think it would be disjointed if we went to a bill first, because you're sort of setting the stage for the bills that we have before us today. So
I apologize for being a little flat-footed. I wonder if what happened to Dan? I need a copy of the group. This. Why don't I? It does seem a little.
And perhaps you can get started with start talking to us a little bit about we have number of sheets in front of us on incentives.
That's where
and,
I was going.
And is that your, is that what you were planning on talking about?
Senator, or Mr. Chairman, my name for the record is Kevin Banks. I'm the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And joining me is Marcia Davis. What I could do, since I'm sitting here and kind
I'll
of
just say Marcia did ask me if she could go get a cup of coffee, and I said
oh,
yes.
No,
so.
It
was. So as we're chatting here, I think Marcia will try to get a slide up for the benefit of those who are in the audience.
I don't have the slide.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, I can speak to a couple of the incentives here that are specifically related to royalties and which are largely managed by the Department of Natural Resources. And then after saying a few words about that, we can pitch it over to Marcia Davis to talk about some of the tax credits. If you go to the royalty modification, 3805-180J provides three kinds of opportunities for lessees to reduce their royalties under certain circumstances. This statute was passed, I think in 1995 with a lot of controversy, but several things about this were, I think, very important and quite valuable. And I'll try to highlight a few of those things. Basically, if you have an existing field and the field is nearing the end of its field life, it is possible under the 180J to reduce the royalty to 3% as a consequence if it can be established that the life of the field can be extended by doing so. I mean, we basically view end of field life is at the point where the revenues coming in for the sale of products, oil and gas off of the lease, exceed the costs of operating costs of running it. So that's that is going to happen with every field. If we can reduce the royalty at that point, there is a chance that we can extend the life of the lease for as much as 18 months, 24 months as a result, given the prices don't change. It also provides for a reduction in royalty should a field shut down for some time. We had a situation that was somewhat similar to that in at Milne Point in the mid-80s when the prices collapsed, and Conoco at the time, who was at that point not the Conoco Phillips we know today, but Conoco was one of the fourth oil companies on the North Slope, had to bring Milne Point into shut-in, and then they subsequently restarted it and applied for royalty relief. Under the circumstances that followed that, the royalty relief wasn't granted, but describes a situation like that. And then, more importantly, in 95, the 180J bill was statute was changed to offer royalty relief before production begins. And that's quite unique in that now we are saying that if there can be a showing that a royalty relief under these terms can affect the economics of a project so that it moves it into the success pile instead of the failure pile, you can move forward with it and get a tax royalty relief down to 5%. There are some requirements of the lessee in order to do that, and requirements of DNR in order to permit it. Because we're talking about a prospective situation, the lessee has to provide the department with sufficient information about the reservoir, the resource itself, and the kinds of costs it expects. And DNR has to evaluate that information against a price forecast and some measure of risk and uncertainty for developing the field. So it requires a certain amount of delineation has to be done of the prospect that's for which the royalty relief will apply. It involves a fairly thorough look on the part of the department to make sure that the state's best interest will be served. And like I use a kind of a bumper sticker expression to describe this process and what we're looking for in a royalty relief credit here, that it be both effective and efficient. It should be effective insofar as it will alter the behavior of the lessee so that they now have a situation, their economics have improved such that they will move ahead and develop. And it's efficient insofar as it grants no more royalty relief than is needed than to achieve achieve the change in behavior. The statute also says that this relief must be tied to some kind of price and may be tied to some other measure of economic success, so that if prices rise, the department can condition the royalty relief on the improved economics that higher prices may cause. Okay, stepping down one more to the discovery royalty, many of the old leases on state land, which are probably all now by either are in production or have long since expired, but there are a few that still remain. It is possible to get discovery royalty of 5% for the first 10 years of production. That's in the row identified as discovery royalty for pre-1969 leases. And as I said, although that's a long time ago that those leases were issued, there are still, I think, a few that may have that opportunity. Cook Inlet also has a discovery royalty provision for the first 10 years of production. And finally, there was a law passed in, I think, 98 or 99 or thereabouts, which identified six fields or pools that had been discovered earlier, but which, if someone can bring those into production, the first, I believe, 25 million barrels of oil, or the first 35 BCF of gas, are subject to a 5% royalty, you know, for the first 10 years of that the field is in production. But as you see, the field must be in production by, I think, 2004. So there's something of a built-in time limit there. And as I point out, the fields that were subject to that are Nikolai Creek, Redoubt Shoals, West Foreland, North Fork, Sturchikoff, which were not in production at that point. Right now, Nikolai Creek is in production. North Fork is subject to is under development right now by Armstrong. Redoubt Shoals is now gone through a that was one of the properties involved in the bankruptcy of Pacific Energy. It is now owned by Cook Inlet Energy. So that sort of speaks to some of the issues that we have. We also have managed an exploration licensing program. I don't know if that's particularly the incentive in the way we normally speak about it, but we offer, starting tomorrow and for the rest of the month, is something of a period in which applicants for exploration license can come to the Department of Natural Resources with suggestions to acquire land in areas outside of the Cook Inlet, outside of the North Slope, and with nothing more than the size of a work commitment, acquire limited rights to exploration, which upon completion of some work commitments that may be offered by the applicant in that situation, that license converts to oil and gas, conventional oil and gas leases. So it is an incentive in one regard, in that there is no competitive bidding, or not necessarily any competitive bidding unless we have challenges for the same piece of property, but there's no bonus bidding involved, so that the cash is going, that would normally go to the state in the form of a bonus bid, goes to the ground, so to speak, in the form of some exploration program. That's DNR's piece, so maybe I should hand it over to Marcia for DOR's part.
If there's any questions. Any questions for Mr. Banks? Okay, Marcia.
My name's Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. And quickly, because I know you have a lot of other matters on your agenda, the exploration tax credit is essentially anywhere from 30% to 40% of your drilling costs. And drilling costs under our tax statute are kind of a collection of both operating type costs and capital costs. It's a kind of a unique creature under 025.
Marcia, can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
on the, as we go down on these credits, you have the EIC, the ETC. Are they cumulative credits?
It depends on the statute. As I understand it, I think the EIC is exclusive. I mean, I don't think you can get an EIC and say the exploration tax credit. And I'd have to go through and look at each of them, and because usually there's a provision contained in each credit description that says your right to utilize this credit is, you know, you can't use this credit if you've undertaken use of another credit in this title or other title. So I'd have to look at it specifically. The exploration credit also covers seismic, but I'll point out it only covers seismic costs that are outside of an existing unit. Likewise, for the drilling exploration drilling costs, all of those are targeted either if you're outside of 25 miles, you get 40%. If you're between 3 miles outside a unit or 3 miles away from a well and less than 25 miles away from existing units, then you get the 30% credit. And none of these credits are available if the drilling is happening within existing unit boundaries.
Yes, Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My chart, I'm looking under the exploration tax credit. My chart under the grid under North Slope says 30% of drill costs if greater than 25, then 30% if pre-approved. So is that the qualifier? It's the same credit. It's just you've got to get pre-approval.
Exactly. So you have to meet one and two in order to get the 40%.
Right, but I'm just talking about two by itself. If you're less than 3 miles from a well, you can still get pre-approved for up to 30% exploration tax credit.
Yes, that's correct.
And between 3 and 25, what's the situation?
Between 3 and 25, you're still 30% because you're greater than 3 miles.
Got it. Okay. Oh, so it's so when I said less than 3, that's a mistake.
Yes. No. You know, if it's less than 3, you get nothing.
Period, nothing. Okay.
That's correct.
So, okay, got it. So it's 3 to 25, 25 or greater.
Correct. The production tax credit is there are several types. The first one is the qualified capital expenses credit, which is under 023, and that is essentially 20% of what are things that are known as capital qualified capital expenditures, and that is defined in that section as what are essentially the expenditures that qualify principally as intangible drilling costs. They're sort of that's kind of the equation or the definition for qualified capital expenditures. And the trick about the qualified capital expenditure credit is that you can use half in your current year and the other half in the following year.
Marcia, can I just clarify? So you're on the production tax credit section, and then you have it broken down by North Slope and then Cook Inlet, and then
correct.
And Cook Inlet, you say same as column one. Column one, you're referring to the North Slope?
That's correct.
Thank you.
The other credit is the loss carryforward credit, and that is also contained in 023. And that one is essentially if you're a producer that has capital credits, capital expenditures, and you can't, I mean, essentially lease expenditures, and you can't fully deduct those. In other words, you've earned less than you expended that year. You essentially have a loss for the year, and you're allowed to take 25% of that amount and use it in the following year as your net operating loss credit, up to 25%.
And Mr. Chair,
yes. Senator
what happens to the other 75%?
That
goes away.
Yeah.
And they're not so they're transferable in the sense that you can push them forward, but they're not transferable. You can't sell them.
That's correct. And actually, let me qualify that. Your net operating loss is essentially you take 25% of your capital expenses that you had. So if that equates to the full loss that you had, that's what you've got. But you can't claim a loss for more than what was 25% of your capital expenditures in that year.
Thank you.
The third credit is what's known as, we call it the small producer credit or frontier basin credit as a way to distinguish. There are two credits that people sometimes miss in one section. The first one under subsection A is $6 million. That is a credit given to someone who has production that is less than 50,000 barrels a year, and it's located, that production is coming out of non-North Slope, non-Cook Inlet properties. The second small producer credit is a credit of up to $12 million, and this can be for, again, a producer that has less than 100,000 barrels average a day, and down to, obviously, lower. But they get up to $12 million. So for a producer that has 50,000 barrels or less a year, they'll get the full $12 million. Between 50,000 and 100,000, it gets proportionately drawn down. And finally, the other benefit we have under the production tax is what's called the economic limit factor. It's the reduced tax that's been applied for Cook Inlet-related properties. The net effect of that is that the maximum tax on gas coming out of the Cook Inlet region for gas is 17 cents per MCF by formula. It doesn't say 17 cents, but when you do the math, that's what you end up with. And on oil, the maximum tax is $0 per barrel.
Pretty good tax rate. Anything else?
That's it as far as sort of the compendium of various credits that exist under current law.
Questions? Yes, Senator French.
Which of these, if any, can be combined with one another? That is, can you combine the exploration tax credit and the production tax credits? Are they separate animals?
The same expenditure can either be used as an exploration tax credit or as a qualified capital expenditure credit. It can't be both.
And which of these, if any, can be sold either to the state or to another producer?
The exploration tax credit, the capital credit under 023, and the I'm not sure if the net operating loss one is Dan here. I think the net operating loss can also be cashed out.
So the qualifying CapEx credits 023A and the
023B and the 025, but not the small producer credits.
Okay, so 025, 023A, 023B, all transferable or sellable on the market.
And those are only, Representative French, Senator French through the chair, those are only cashable by taxpayers who have 50,000 barrels or less of production average per day.
Marcia, I want to bore down a little bit into the difference between the EIC and the ETC. So just looking exploration and incentive credits, you get up to 50% of drilling based on depth and location. And then the exploration tax credit, you get 30% of the drill costs if greater than 10 miles from existing units. So
40.
If I may try to explain what an EIC means to us.
Please.
It's a DNR offered credit that becomes a term of the lease before the lease sale. We can add it to as an incentive when we go to lease the land. And generally speaking, it's some proportion of the well cost. Maybe it's some amount of money per foot, or it's some percentage of the total cost up to 50%. And that becomes now a term of the lease. And then the lease is offered up in a competitive bidding situation. So it makes the lease more attractive.
So that's the EIC.
That is the EIC, yes.
And so there's no stacking. In other words, the first, I guess, default would be the exploration tax credit, which anyone would be eligible for, mm-hmm. which would be, let's say it's more than 10 miles from an existing unit in Cook Inlet, that would be 30%. But if you deemed a particular lease to be something that you wanted to incentivize, you could raise that 30% up to 50%. Is that how that works?
I'm not exactly sure if the EICs under a lease under 3805 is additive to the expiration tax credit.
I'm looking right now at 025 just to see if I see the magic phrase that say it's not additive, because essentially it will be additive unless we say otherwise, mm-hmm. and I'm not seeing any exclusion, so I think it would be additive.
You could get an 80% tax credit?
If I offered leases with that 50% credit, yes. That's how that calculation would work.
Okay, and then the royalty modification, again, that's similar to the expiration incentive credit, where that's something that you offer to potential lessees. Is that something that you attach to the lease before it's leased out, or is that something that a producer can come to you and say, hey, this is a marginal field, give us some royalty relief? How does that process work?
Mr. Chairman, that it works in the latter case. It is not a provision of the lease. It is a provision in statute that allows a lessee, at least under 180J, with respect to the prospective royalty relief, that they may come to us and apply for it.
How, and can I ask what percentage or how many leases in Cook Inlet have a royalty modification?
There are none in the Cook Inlet. The only two places today that have royalty modification of the form, 180J, A form, is the leases in Ugaruk on the North Slope and in the Nekiachuk unit. And I may also add that under the circumstances, when Nekiachuk was evaluated, we'd already saw, that was after PPT had passed, and in the evaluation of the economics of the Nekiachuk field, we accounted for the economic effects of the then PPT tax regime that applied to that.
Senator French.
Thank you. And on that royalty modification, I mean, the basic argument you're going to be confronted with from a producer is the economics of this field are challenged mm-hmm. for whatever reason. Is there any limit on the reasons they can present to you? It's, you know, it's too far from existing infrastructure, you know, difficult formation to produce, heavy oil, something like that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator French, it that all gets boiled down to how much it costs to develop the field. And you know, distance would matter because now you've got infrastructure that perhaps it needs to be constructed and to supply it, you know, to build in pipelines and what have you. So we'll capture most of those kinds of issues in with respect to the cost of development.
And how about the tax burden? Is there anything that prevents a producer from coming to you and saying, you know, the taxes on this field are so high that it makes it an economically challenged field. We need you to lower the royalty so that this field can stay in production for the foreseeable future. Is there anything that prevents them from making that argument?
Through the chair, Senator French, no, I don't think so. That is a plausible argument, and it would be incorporated in our evaluation, as would be also how the progressivity would work and to the extent that progressivity helps when prices fall, that would be the way we would craft our royalty relief if we hit that sweet point between being effective. And quite frankly, what it turns out in the evaluations that we've done so far is that moving a royalty rate from the average of about 12.5% down to 5% often doesn't make a very big difference in the economics of a project, because the royalties are paid basically after production begins and after a great deal of the money has been spent. So you're trying to induce some kind of change in behavior with cash or royalty benefits under the royalty relief with discounted dollars in the cash flow calculation. So they're not directly hitting the lessee when they're spending the money.
Senator French.
It sounds like you're making a general comment on the productivity and or not productivity, but the profitability of existing oil fields, that once you've sunk those enormous costs into roads, pads, seismic work, wells, surface facilities, once you've got all that sunk, it's hard to make an economic argument that a 7% reduction in your royalty is going to make a big difference in the economics of the field.
That, through the chair, Senator French, that's correct. And remember, we're evaluating these prospects before production begins, before a major investment occurs. There's probably been a well or two drilled into the prospect. We have some sense of how big the prospect is. It's been delineated, and now we're moving to the next step where we have enough information to come to some conclusion about its profitability. My point is only that if you're offering some sort of relief of royalty, the relief will occur typically after all of the big money has been spent.
But just to go back and complete the point, if I could, I think my first question was, is there anything that prevents a producer from an existing field? This reduction is not only available prospectively to fields that haven't been brought online, or is it? Am I wrong? Or can it be brought with any lease that the state oversees?
Senator French, through the chair, this prospective is only provided to fields that are not in production.
Not in production. Okay, thank you.
And then, of course, as I mentioned, there was the shut-in and the field life case, which is a different set of of issues and are evaluated differently.
Kevin, what are the factors that you look at in determining whether or not you should grant a royalty modification? What's sort of the touchstone? Do you look at internal rate of return or net profit? What are you looking at?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we are looking at how I think the best way to describe it is that we try to place the economics of the project into what a prudent operator would be. So we pull it out of the situation that may be unique for that particular company that is applying for the royalty relief and distill it into what would motivate a prudent operator to move forward with a project. And so we are looking at the kinds of, precisely the kinds of economic measures like net present value of the project at some discount rate, the internal rate of return. Occasionally we'll touch on the efficiency, capital efficiency, how much investment is required to get what kind of return on investment. And we're also trying to do that in a measuring uncertainty in risk as well, because that has some effect on what happens if this becomes wildly successful. Do we still want to be in a situation where relief is being offered in the off chance that the project becomes more successful than any of us could anticipate? But if you can, I think what I'm trying to say is that we try to make this to structure the design of the prospect around what would a hypothetical prudent operator, what would trigger them to move forward in the project, rather than to try to match some sort of hurdle rate that might be the case for the applicant.
Yes, Marcia.
I wanted to clarify an earlier answer I gave. And that was when asked, is this the only incentive, I mean, is that it for tax? And it is it for production tax, but there's another tax provision that should be on this chart, and that's the corporate income tax credit, known as the gas exploration and development tax credit. And that's under Alaska Statute 43.20.043. And that provision provides for gas exploration expenditures that are non-North Slope gas, and it provides under current law, 10% of those expenditures become a credit against the corporate income tax. That provision states that if you utilize that corporate income tax credit that is currently 10%, it is in lieu of the exploration incentive credit or any of the production tax credits, although some of the language is a little problematic. And I wanted to go back and answer specifically the question that that you had, Chairman Wilikowski, about which credits are in lieu of other credits. The only provision under the production tax regime, which, as I listed, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, potentially 4 or 5 benefits there. The only one that has to be exclusive is the capital credit under 023A. If you utilize that 20% of your capital expenditures, you can't essentially apply the exploration credit or the EIC credit or the corporate income tax credit to those expenditures. But if, for instance, I'll use an example, a new player who's going to be under that 50,000 threshold, let's take that entity, they could do an exploration well that would qualify for the exploration tax credit. If they don't have a lot of production, they're likely going to have a lot of expenses and not much income, so they'll generate a net operating loss credit. And they also could conceivably qualify for the small producer credit for the potentially the $12 million. And depending upon where they're located, if it's in not North Slope or not Cook Inlet, they could also get the $6 million. So there are ways to essentially set these up in an additive fashion if you're a new player, a new entrant. If you are at what I'll call an incumbent with more production than 100,000 barrels a day, then you're essentially looking at the capital credit, exploration tax credit as an alternative for the same expenditures. And if you have net operating losses, you'd have those.
Thank you, Marcia. I want to go back to where we were, because it really cuts, I think, to the heart of the issue. You're out there evaluating what you think would incentivize exploration in Cook Inlet. And that's what we're all trying to get to, is that sweet spot, without giving too much, without giving away more than we need to. And so what are your thoughts on what we need to do to achieve the kind of rate of return and net present value for the producers to continue to explore, and also for the new entrants to come in and explore?
Well, Senator, Mr. Chairman, the under 180J, there is a very hard look at the kinds of economics that can be anticipated for a particular project, and it is not automatic. An applicant can come to us, apply for royalty relief, and we may find, in fact, that we can't offer enough relief to make a difference, or that the project actually lives without the without relief. And what you've seen, I think, in the last several weeks here in the legislature is the concern raised by many that the fact that there is this, it isn't automatic. It's too difficult to organize your financing on the bet that you can persuade the Department of Natural Resources to see things their way or something like that. That folks, I think, are looking for credits that are based on some percentage of their expenses, or just a credit that may be driven by some other measure. I would argue, at least in a credit that that involves some kind of assurance that the applicant is or taxpayer is going to be spending money in order to get money. I mean, to a certain extent, the state's protected because the party asking for the money is putting up some of its own resources, and I think that's it helps to a degree, but of course we aren't looking at a lot of these credits with the kind of eye that a 180J application would have to have. That's just the way it is.
And we're getting close to the time that I wanted to finish. Just one question, I'll get to you, Senator Huggins. How do our credits compare to other countries, other states? Do you have any sense? Our credits and incentives, if for Cook Inlet in particular?
I really can't answer that. As far as the kinds of credits that DNR offers, there isn't really an example like that around the country. The federal government offered royalty incentives for OCS in the Gulf of Mexico. That became quite controversial as prices rose, but I can't say that we've done that kind of evaluation.
Thank you. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Standard deduction, where would that fit on this sheet?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, the standard deduction is a means of calculating what the lease expenditures are. So it actually is part of the tax calculation at arriving at what the production tax value is. So we did not include that as an incentive.
I understand. So, but since it's now expired, I understand. What was the net effect of standard deduction?
I believe we presented that earlier in the session in terms of what the value of that standard deduction was.
Not the money.
Oh. The effect was that you essentially took the 2006 level of lease expenditures for the two large fields, Prudhoe Bay and Kuparik, and locked those in as the expenditure level, the lease expenditure level that would be allowed for forward years for 3 years, with it being escalated by roughly 2%. Yes.
Yes, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. Under whichever category is appropriate, but let's just look at exploration tax credit and the proximities that are listed here as they're broken out on the North Slope, 25 miles, 3 miles, and then 1 and 2 above. Has that proximity piece, has that been about right, or is there an adjustment that's required for those, or what would be your comment?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, in terms of the distance piece of that, I think our experience has been that there have been some wells drilled, but the taxpayer has chosen to utilize the credits that are available in some instances under the capital expense credits because those are immediately and readily cashable or returnable. There's less of a time lag involved with those, so they're choosing immediate money over some of the inherent delays associated with the exploration tax credit. At least that's some of the what I'll call the rumor mill.
So for new investment, when you look at the categories on the North Slope, what's the most effective, and what do you see the effect of that in 2010 as far as exploration?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, we did a quick look at the tax returns that we the last full tax returns that we have are for 2008, because the 2009 tax returns we're going to get in the end of March, today actually, and what we found is approximately 91% of the credits that were applied for and used against taxes, I'll just say gained and then applied against tax liabilities, were the 023 credits, and approximately 6% were in the exploration tax credit regime. So I would say that the vast bulk of credits that we're issuing are in the capital credits category. Now, the statistics I just gave you do not include companies that are currently incurring costs that have no production. I would expect those companies would be more heavily tilted toward the exploration credit, but it would be smaller expenditures.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right, thank you. Other questions? Okay, just real quick, if you could, any initial reactions to President Obama's decision to expand the drilling allowable areas in Cook Inlet? Is that going to have an impact on any of this?
Senator, I'm still trying to figure out exactly what it was that President Obama did. It appears as though there'll be progress on the existing leases in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea, and that's a good thing. I remain concerned that there may be some kind of moratorium on future lease sales until studies are completed, and that's about where I can go with this. The opportunity to add to your prospect with some expected timing, you know, as a lessee begins to develop its or explore its own existing prospects is fairly important, and it's unfortunate that there may actually be a delay before someone can add to their property.
If you could get back to us when you perform some sort of initial analysis, because I had read that there was some expansion in Cook Inlet, and so I don't know anything else about it, but that could, I'm guessing, have some sort of an impact on the bills that we have before us. So
okay.
Any sort of input you can get to us on that would be appreciated. All right, any final questions?
Just one point. If you drew a line somewhere near Anchor Point across the inlet, that's about where the OCS begins as you're heading south. So just to give you a point of reference. So yeah, we're talking about areas, Cosmopolitan, for example, at Anchor Point actually is part of its leasehold is in federal land, so there could very well be an impact.
Okay, good to see you as always. Thank you for coming and appearing before us. Okay, we now are going to take up our first bill on this issue, Senate Bill 309, Gas Exploration and Development Tax Credits. We have with us Mike Pulaski from Senator McGuire's office, who will present the bill on behalf of the Rules Committee. And Mr. Pulaski, welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Pulaski, and I'm an aide to Senator McGuire's office. To clarify, the legislation was offered at the request of the Senate Energy Committee and Senator McGuire, not at the request of the Rules Committee. But we truly appreciate the Rules Chairman's latitude in letting us bring this bill to the committee's attention. Just for the committee's, I think, help, what I'd do is start off on the incentive sheet that you were just working off of. And you'll see the area that Senate Bill 309 deals with is under the exploration tax credit, the second smaller language listed there, AS4320043. This is a tax credit that is specific to below the 68th parallel. And if you'll notice the three stars on the sheet, this credit cannot be taken in conjunction with other credits or royalty modifications. So it's specific to exploration really within the Cook Inlet or south of the 68th parallel and is not stackable with the other credits. What Senate Bill 309 does is take the existing credit and make some substantive changes to it that I think get towards what we saw come out of the DNR Cook Inlet study and the recent Petrotech technical resources assessment that the utilities prepared. One of the substantive changes you will find really on page 3 of the bill, lines 25. This is in section 5. One of the principles underlying Senate Bill 309 is that the best place to look for gas is probably within a gas field. And in that, the old exploration incentive tax credit had to be on land that was not had not been under production or had not been explored for. This actually frees it up so that wells that are drilled within an existing field can qualify for this incentive as well. The incentive is further modified if we go back to page 2. The new language added from line 6 through line 18 is increasing from the 10% to a 25%. Recall that this credit is against corporate income taxes, not against production taxes. Therefore, the third substantive change is back on page 3 in section 3. Traditionally, originally, this credit was only applicable against 50% of your corporate income tax obligation. Senate Bill 309 removes that 50% cap and allows the credit to be claimed against the total tax liability that the taxpayer is accruing. The further thing that the bill does in general, Mr. Chairman, is in the final two sections, Section 7 and Section 8, and that is to extend the sunset. This exploration incentive tax credit is set to expire in 2013. The bill would extend it to 2020 with a transitional sunset to 2024 for any carry-forward credit against a future tax obligation. That's the real general goal of Senate Bill 309, Mr. Chairman, is to take an exclusive program, make it work more for the Cook Inlet based on what some of the recent recommendations we've seen in studies and reports. And I'd be happy to answer questions from the committee.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Huggins.
Fish, when you look at the elements of the bill, what makes you think that these incentives will have an effect, a net effect? Now, before you answer that, I mean, I guess I would say thank you for doing something, because something is better than nothing, because we know what the results we're getting now is nothing. So, please.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, the issue, I think, in Cook Inlet is related to what is the production tax. We know that's not very big. On the other hand, corporations that are operating in Cook Inlet might have substantive corporate income tax. So this tax credit being designed to apply against that tax exclusively, where you can't take other taxes, provides a tool in the toolbox that might work for a corporation that might not want to use one of the other credits. Further, I think the extension to allowing development of an existing field rather than looking outside of the existing fields really is what gets to the heart of the need of the bill. In that, that's where we are most likely to find gas in the near term.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. Other questions? Okay, Fish, let me ask you a few questions. So just walking through the bill, Section 1, you're increasing that 10% tax to 25%. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, for tax years after 2009.
And that's for 10% for capital investment and 10% of annual cost? Or, I'm sorry, 25% of capital investment, 25% of annual cost?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay. And let's see. Looking at lines 13 through 18 of page 2, explain to me what you've got. Six lines there rather than just change the 10 to a 25. Why do you need six lines to do that?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that we are in that there might be transition from the original credits, the 10% credits. We have to mirror the language from line 4 through 9 on page 2 as well. So in that you're adding a new 25% credit, this is transition language from the pre-existing 10% credit to the new 25% credit. So it has to mirror itself in statute.
Okay, and then section 2, I you know, just for at least for my sake, this is a fairly, I think it's somewhat simple, but when I read the language, it's a little complicated. So maybe you could tell me what section, and we'll walk through the sections and tell me what section 2 does.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding of Section 2, and I'd be happy to be corrected by Marcia Davis.
Or do we have a drafter or someone else that you...
I do not have the drafter available, okay. Mr. Chairman, but the Department of Revenue is available.
Okay. Marcia, do you want to come up again? Do you want to walk us through this, Fish, or do you want? Would you rather Marcia do it?
I think I'd be happy to be corrected by the Department of Revenue.
Are you, if you could just state your name again for the record, Marcia. And do you feel comfortable walking through this section?
Sure. Okay. My name is Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. I had walked through this, this was the initial version of the bill, similar version on the House side, which is known as, I think it's House Bill 229.
That's correct.
And so this was the version they started out with. It has since been amended and modified. So I'll try to reel myself back in time.
So Section 1, we're just changing the 10 to 25%, correct?
Yes, essentially they're leaving intact the 10% up until the end of the tax year 2009. And then beginning with the tax year 2010, they're increasing the credit from 10% to 25%.
Section 2, if you go to line 21, you're change going from A1 to A1A and A2A, and maybe you could tell us what that does.
I believe this is also simply just trying to accommodate the split in the two different tax years. So they're splitting up, instead of it being, for instance, the line 21, instead of it being just a reference to A1, now it's splitting it up between the pre-2010 and post-2010 era. One of the things that's sort of hidden here is you've got the split of the credit being for capital investment. It's called taxpayers' qualified capital investment, which is a term of art, and then there's qualified services, which is also a term of art, and both of those terms are defined at the back end of this tax section. So that's why they're in two pieces, so you'll see two A's and, there'll be a 1A, 1B, and a 2A and a 2B.
Why are you changing reserves to wells on line 29?
It's again, this happened before I became associated with the bill, but I believe one of the attempts was made, and it's relating to what's on top of page 3. There was an effort here made to change the credit from being one that was success-oriented to one that gave a credit for the action of drilling the well and doing the exploration without regard to whether they ended up with a successful commercial producing gas well. And so the breakout there, I believe, they're moving away from reserves to simply the well being drilled.
And is that being changed, Fish, or is that...
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that in a lot of ways it's also clerical in that reserves are produced, but it's a well that actually produces gas. So if you read the language, it was to get towards sort of that concept. And Ms. Davis is correct that to get away from the success case as well.
Okay. Section 3?
In Section 3, I believe this change is in two-part. I understand Ledge Legal is trying to remove the word per everywhere they see it. So that was the line 7 change. And then on line 8, this is the removing of the cap of 50% of the income tax liability. So now this credit can draw down the income tax liability entirely instead of just down to 50%.
Let me just ask a question. If you have a producer that produces in Cook Inlet and also has exploration on the North Slope, there's no ring fencing. We're allowing them to write off taxes from this on North Slope production.
Chairman Wilikowski, yes, under the corporate income tax, they do not look at different parts of the state. It's all combined.
Okay. Section 4?
Section 4 was in the initial version of the bill at 229, and this change, I'm not sure why it was in, but it came out pretty quickly, and we had serious concerns about the language. And the way it was written, where it says a taxpayer is not entitled to a credit for capital expenditures or qualified services made for activities related to gas on the North Slope. That's essentially what this paragraph is supposed to do. But the problem was it also tried to, I think the effort of the original drafting was a concern that they tie it down. What if there were gas lines that moved North Slope gas to Tidewater? And it ended up being unnecessary, because if you're going to exclude North Slope gas, it doesn't matter where it goes once it's excluded from North Slope. It was unnecessary to put in a line about no matter how it gets delivered. Because our concern was, when it says for the delivery of Alaska North Slope gas to Tidewater below the North Slope, that then suggested, oh, but you will allow the inclusion of a gas line to Canada. It was incomplete as written, so it became more problematic to try to fix it than just simply to eliminate it. But
so you're proposing that this be eliminated?
Well, as it stands now, it creates an ambiguity, which is that we are excluding a pipeline from the North Slope to Valdez or to Cook Inlet, but not excluding a pipeline from the North Slope to Canada. And I'm confident that was not the drafter's intent. And when they saw that, they realized that Section F, as it stood currently, was adequate to simply preclude inclusion of North Slope gas.
Just so I'm clear, this entire bill only applies to south of 68 degrees?
That is correct, Chairman Wilikowski.
And does that include Gubik?
I'll have to refer to Kevin Banks on that.
Mr. Chairman, it's Kevin Banks from the Division of Oil and Gas. Gubik is well north of the 68 degree parallel.
And let me just ask you while you're there, is there any significant development or exploration going on south of 68 degrees that we haven't, I mean, we know about Cook Inlet, we know about Nanana. Anything else out there?
Possibly. There are people here that could speak to it better than I, but I know there's proposals for some exploration activities in the Yukon-Charlie region in northwest Alaska.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, Marcia, Section 5.
Section 5 is the language of the bill that purports to deal with a failure leg, essentially. They've added in language, if the exploration and development activity touch on gas reserves, regardless of whether there has been commercial production in the area, in other words, they can go back into a previously explored area, or whether the exploration and development activity results in the production of a well, gas, or a well not capable of commercial production. So again, the idea that they could end up having a mediocre well and it would still be covered. I will raise one question, and that is, because of the use of the phrase gas reserve throughout this whole thing, from a department's administration standpoint, we'll probably have to lean heavily on Department of Natural Resources, because what we're left with the impression is, if there was a rank exploration wildcat, a rank wildcat type gas exploration well, and there's no indication that there are gas reserves, and they drill a dry hole, then the bill is written, and the original statute is written, would suggest that we're not accessing or touching gas reserves. So in that one instance, this bill would not seem to apply.
Section 6.
Before we leave Section 5 also does a very important thing, which is defines what is considered to be the qualified capital investment. And when we go down through the list of properties A, B, C, and then the breakdown within C, there is concern about the listing under Romanet 2. And that is the inclusion of the words topping plant, and that was cleaned up on the House side, because that refers to a crude oil process for refining, and it simply doesn't belong in a gas bill. Concern was expressed about processing units and whether that included an LNG plant. Technically, from an engineering standpoint, it would, and so the House cleaned that up by re-referencing that as gas processing and gas treatment plants. So it was clear it was both downstream and upstream gas processing that would typically be normal things, but excluding liquid natural gas or other manufacturing plants. So that language buttoned that down tightly. And finally, concern about a power plant. They didn't want to have subsidized by the corporate income tax credit a power plant that powered South Central. So that was limited to power plants necessary for field operation.
Section 6?
Section 6 is simply, let's see, what is that? Taxpayer shall claim the credit in any other amount of time if it was qualified as made. Time for the year. It's basically setting, clarifying when the timing of the credit is being filed, and I guess that was missing from the original section, and it helps eliminate that.
Section 7?
And Section 7 is cleaning up the dates, referencing the various dates. These are the uncodified laws that were embedded in the original passage of the corporate income tax, and cleaning up the dates related to those, which is changing from 2017 to 2024, the last year that you can use the credit. And likewise, Section 8, moving it from 2013 to 2020, when the credit itself would expire. And Chairman Wilikowski, through the chair, one question that got asked today in a hearing on that House Bill 229 was whether this credit clearly was in lieu of the other credits. And at my testimony there, I made a misstatement, or at least it, when I went and read the section, the current law, which is 4320043, there's a subsection G, and that subsection currently states, a taxpayer who obtains a credit under this section may not claim a tax credit or royalty modification provided under any other title. That begs the question that since this is contained in 43.20, since the production tax is in 4355, technically it is not in an other title. So to correct that, because I think that clearly is the intent of the drafter, not to alter the assumption that this is not an additive credit, you would need to insert the language this or any other title. And likewise, for the benefit of the taxpayer, the second line of that, however, a taxpayer may, at the taxpayer's election, forego a credit under this section in order to continue to qualify for a credit provided for in, it says, another title. Again, I would say this or another title. So if they forego this credit, they can partake in the 4355 credits.
Marsha, thank you. Let me just ask you, does the administration have a position on the bill?
I do not know.
Questions? Thank you for that impromptu. Anything else, Fish?
Mr. Chairman, no. I think that explains some of the things that were caught very recently on the bill.
Thank you. We've got a couple people signed up to testify, and we have two other bills behind us, and I'm hoping that we can get to those in a substantive way. We'll go to Carrie Lockhart. And I'm going to limit testimony to 3 minutes. And welcome to the committee, Carrie. Good to see you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Carrie Lockhart. I am the production manager for Marathon's Alaska operations. And by way of background, Marathon has been operating in Cook Inlets for over 55 years. Our operations are limited to Cook Inlets, and we sell roughly 87 million cubic feet a day to all of the current markets available to us, including the utilities, Tesoro, the Department of Defense. And we do send gas to the LNG plant that is co-owned with ConocoPhillips. As you're aware, in 2003, legislature passed and the governor signed several bills directing providing incentives for new exploration development activities. And Marathon was particularly interested in the House Bill 61, which was intended to incentivize exploration and development of natural gas reserves in Cook Inlet. And we did talk about the provisions and the changes in this Senate Bill 309. So one might ask the need to provide incentives for natural gas development in Cook Inlet. And the answer to this question is found by considering the long-term decline in natural gas reserves and deliverability, which Cook Inlet has experienced. What must be addressed is whether there's currently sufficient exploration development activity to address such decline in reserves and deliverability, and simply not to ask whether Cook Inlet is running out of gas. At the current level of activity, it is unlikely that Cook Inlet reserve additions will replace annual production on a long-term ongoing basis, and that's the key, long-term ongoing basis. Such natural gas reserves and deliverability are at risk for continued decline, resulting in exposure to unmet utility needs, which would impact us all. The lack of activity is an artifact of historic oversupply of natural gas, which kept prices well below lower 48 index prices, creating a lack of incentive for additional drilling. And further, regulatory processes and deterioration in market availability have added to project uncertainty. The project economics and market uncertainties have made it difficult for projects to compete effectively for finite funding. So what can be done to ensure the reliability? The answer is not simple and includes several things that are being discussed primarily today: storage, market access and certainty, and economic projects. Great work is going on to try to address the needs and try to find a solution in a mutually beneficial manner. So 309, how will that help? Well, Alaska projects, as we all know, are not solely considered on their absolute merits. They are scrutinized on a relative scale in comparison to other worldwide opportunities in which companies such as Marathon may invest. The intent of Senate Bill 309 is to help level the playing field between the Alaskan projects and other investment opportunities around the world. So we are targeting one of the three pieces of the puzzle that need to be fixed in order to ensure natural gas reliability. So in summary, Marathon Oil believes that Senate Bill 309 is one part of the equation to enhance Cook Inlet exploration and development activities, attempting to create more certainty in the overall natural gas deliverability in Cook Inlet. And I'd like to reiterate that in order to qualify for this investment tax credit, the producer must make capital investments adding to some level of value back to the state and industry on its own, just across the entire value chain, which is necessary to meet the overall deliverability needs of South Central. So with that, I would be happy to entertain any questions that anybody may have.
Gary, thank you. I know you had a lot of written testimony there. If you wanted to get us a copy, we could get that to the entire committee. Questions? Okay, thank you. Going to the off-nets, we've got Mark Land from Renaissance.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on Senate Bill 309. And I'm actually prepared some remarks specifically related to an amendment that I understand was going to be added to 309 related to the repeal of the future spend requirements under the existing tax credits. Is it appropriate for me to proceed?
Yeah, go ahead. We have the amendment in our packet. It hasn't been introduced yet, but why don't you go ahead? You got three minutes.
Okay, I'll try to zip through this. Just to introduce myself, I'm Renaissance Alaska and Buccaneer Alaska. My name is Mark Lant. I'm Executive Vice President of Land and Administration for Renaissance and Vice President of Land and Business Development for Buccaneer Alaska. Renaissance is headquartered in Houston, Texas, and Buccaneer Energy Limited is a publicly traded company in Australia with an operating office in Houston. Renaissance was formed in November 2006 and completed the initial funding of a business plan that solely focuses on growth in Alaska. The major area of focus for Renaissance is the Umiata oil field on the North Slope. Buccaneer Alaska is a newly formed subsidiary of Buccaneer Energy Limited and was recently formed last week to solely focus on growth in Alaska and is currently focused on oil and gas opportunities in the Cook Inlet. The Renaissance and Buccaneer team have over 80 years of experience. We're composed of proven oil finders, value creators in Alaska and other basins worldwide. The team members have identified, captured, funded, and developed oil and gas projects resulting in cumulative recoverable reserves of over a billion barrels of oil equivalent. In fact, many of the team members worked together in the discovery and development of the Alpine oil field on the North Slope of Alaska with our previous employers. Since its formation, Renaissance has acquired BLM and state oil and gas leases on 19,000 acres located on the Umiata oil field, the National Petroleum Reserve, and the Gubik gas field on the North Slope. Buccaneer has entered in just in the last week into a purchase and sale agreement with Stellar Oil and Gas to acquire 58,000 acres located in the Cook Inlet and Kenai Peninsula in South Central Alaska. Since 2006, Renaissance has spent in excess of $40 million completing exploration and evaluation operations in the state. Significant amount of these funds were focused on evaluating the existing oil field at Umiat with a modern 3D seismic survey. The tax credits under ACES is a significant reason why Renaissance remains in Alaska, and we believe the availability of those credits will play a critical role in attracting the required investment to develop the Umiat oil field. The tax credits are also a significant reason for the entry of Buccaneer into the Cook Inlet. Renaissance has applied for a total of $19.2 million in tax credits, received $1.3 million from the state of Alaska, $7.45 million from North Slope taxpayers in the sale of these certificates, and have approximately $7.6 million in certificates that we've been unable to monetize. A majority of these $7.6 million in tax certificates were received in July 2009, and to date, as I mentioned, Renaissance has been unable to monetize these on acceptable terms. As I mentioned earlier, Umiat is a known oil accumulation with potential for near-term development. Umiat has real potential, and we believe to be one of the best opportunities to supply up to 50,000 barrels per day, two taps, in the near term. Based on the work completed by Renaissance and the other activities conducted by the state of Alaska on the road to resources, we believe we are on a path to commerciality. As common in these types of developments, there will be a lull in spending for 2 to 3 years as we incur pre-engineering and permitting of the project.
Mr. Lant, can I get you to wrap it up? And then if you have written testimony, you could get it to us, just because we've really got a lot of testimony and a couple bills behind.
Okay. Well, I'll just say in summary, Renaissance and Buccaneer supports the increased access to capital credits for the new explorers, the repeal of AS 4355.028E2 and E3 as set forth in the Section 8 of Senate Bill 309, the amendment to it. And we support the repeal to provide greater certainty for new investors in Alaska, level the playing field between new and existing operators in Alaska, and eliminate the unfair double standard we believe that exists with the North Slope producers. Thank you.
Mr. Land, thank you for your testimony. Fighting a sneeze. If you did have something in writing you wanted to send to us, we would appreciate it. And we appreciate you you appearing before us. Okay, next up. Yes, Senator Stevens.
I'm sorry, I'm a little confused. We've got an amendment up before us that we have not adopted. He's speaking to that amendment?
There is no amendment that's been before us. There is a proposed amendment. We have it in your packet. It hasn't been offered yet, though, Senator.
From Bullock, this one.
That's correct, yeah. It's /A.1. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Next up, we have Stacey Schubert.
Good afternoon, Chairman Wilikowski and members of the Senate Resource Committee. My name is Stacey Schubert. I'm the Intergovernmental Affairs Director for Mayor Sullivan in Anchorage, and I'm testifying today at the request of Mayor Sullivan. The municipality of Anchorage remains concerned about the declining production of natural gas in the Cook Inlet, specifically as it relates to decreased deliverability through the gas system. You may be aware that one of the first orders of business the mayor acted upon after taking office was to create an energy task force to address the serious energy issues Rail Belt consumers and you and the legislature are faced with today. Just this week, the task force distributed a resolution that raises its concerns that deliverability challenges will escalate in the next 1 to 5 years, and if unaddressed, could result in rolling blackouts or worse. Both the task force and the mayor applaud you in your efforts to address these critical pieces of legislation that address both incentives for storage and incentives for natural gas exploration and production. The mayor also acknowledges the work of the Rail Belt utilities, who have been working with the administration on the Energy Watch program. That is a green, yellow, red system that implores customers to adjust their behavior in the event of an impending energy crisis. Conservation can be a critical component that helps us to help ourselves in the event of an immediate threatened energy crisis. And the steps taken by the mayor are so important. In 2009, Anchorage nearly experienced a catastrophic event, and it's why the mayor has asked me to testify today in support of the concepts proposed in Senate Bill 309, which we believe will encourage exploration in the Cook Inlet and will therefore result in greater reliability for Rail Belt energy consumers. Likewise, the mayor supports the concepts proposed in the bill that passed the House last week, the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, or HB 280, that supports storage efforts. Gas storage is the key to smoothing out the challenges posed by deliverability peaks on cold winter days. The mayor is committed to monitoring Senate Bill 309 and House Bill 280 as they continue to work their way through the legislative process. And in fact, he indicated his support of such during his weekly media briefing just this afternoon. We would appreciate your support of the legislation that we view as critical to Cook Inlet's long-term stability. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right. Thank you, Stacey. Questions? Seeing none. Okay, is there anyone else signed up online to testify?
Just questions.
Okay, seeing none. Anyone else in the room signed up to testify? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. Okay, we're going to set the bill aside, and we'll take it up in the future. All right, next up, we have Senate Bill 290 regarding tax credits to drill wells in Cook Inlet by Senator Wagner. Senator Wagner, do you have any opening comments?
No, Mary Jackson's staff.
Mary, welcome to
present the bill.
Many, please put yourself on the record. And
thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mary Jackson. I'm staff to Senator Tom Wagner, sponsor of Senate Bill 290. This bill deals exclusively with exploration. We call it the Cook Inlet Stampede, patterned after the Oklahoma land rush. It basically says the first, second, and third explorer that comes gets a good benefit, 100%, and then down to 75%, and then down to 50%. It's offered under the alternative tax credit for oil and gas exploration, which is Section 1 of the bill. Section 2 of the bill defines exactly what it is. Very basic. It defines the first three explorers. It drills into the subcretaceous zone, and there's some discussion on whether or not that's the appropriate term. It allows for only one credit per explorer, and if more than one qualifies, if there's two of them that are racing toward the event, the department makes the determination on what percentage of the credit goes to each of those explorers. A unique twist to it. If the exploration results in production in paying quantities, the credits are required to be repaid by 50%. And finally, it strengthens the basin, because if you get the explorers in and they actually start producing, clearly that strengthens the basin. The rest of the packet is a sponsor statement, sectional analysis. There was a memorandum from the Department of Revenue that we received in November of last year that I think you just had a very good review of by the department, so you don't even need to go through that. I would point out there is a letter of support from Escapeda, from Mr. Danny Davis, and then there are two color pictures. One is a stratigraphic map that actually depicts the zones, whether it's the Mesozoic, the Tertiary, all of the wonderful words that go into it. We call it the Jurassic because it's a recognizable one, and I saw the film. The other one that we have is just the oil and gas activity map, and that's a recent one from the department. Two other things that came into your packet later after what we submitted. One was the fiscal note from the Department of Revenue. It's a March 30th fiscal note. It's indeterminate. I just wanted to point out to you, and first of all, we recognize how difficult it must be for them to put a fiscal note together. It presumes or doesn't presume. If there is exploration, and if it becomes a paying quantities, then there is a 50% credit back. But I wanted to point out to you just to recognize that this new credit, if it's a $20 million bill for an exploration, and they would originally have gotten a 40% credit, it's a difference of 60%, not the full $20 million. That was all. And of course, if by some reason, some good luck, we go into production, 50% is a payback. Other than that, Mr. Chairman, we have identified some issues with the bill, and that's on page 2 of the packet that was submitted. The first one is to make sure that it is very, very clear this is intended only for offshore. This is not intended to extend credits for onshore, only to the offshore. So the recommendation is that language be developed through legislative legal that clarifies that. And an offshoot of that, the offshore in the Cook Inlet Basin is all state leases. One of the benefits of drilling exploration, even if there is no hit, is the information is received from the drilling of the well is public. DNR gets it. They're able to see it. If it's on state lands, it is all on state lands in the offshore. The second thing is a recommendation from Department of Natural Resources to change the sub-Cretaceous to the pre-tertiary. And I readily admit that discussion of why that is necessary is beyond my pay range. So the department is here, and I'm sure can readily address it, and there are the color pictures there, as well as more information if that's necessary. And the third point was a consideration from Senator Wagner to talk about the need for possibly 3 credits for jackup rigs and 3 credits specific to structures, permanent structures, platforms that are there. And there may or may not want to be a differential for those. The fourth was a question more from the Department of Revenue as to what is transportation and how that arrives in this bill. And I'm reasonably confident that we've addressed that and clarified it. The last issue is one that was raised by Department of Revenue. It was a handout, this handout right here, from the department. Very valid point. It was an oversight on our part. And that's a 25% of the net operating loss for capital credits. Nowhere was it ever intended that anybody gets 125%. So language needs to be included that says it's 100 and that's it. And other than that, I don't believe I have anything else.
Thank you, Mary.
You're welcome.
Questions? Okay. And can we get the administration to come up real quick on this? Marcia, do you want to come forward? And while Marcia's coming up, I just want to read into the record this statement from the letter from Escopeta Oil, because it's pretty amazing. It says, and this is a quote, Escopeta predicts the kitchen lights unit contains approximately 440 million barrels of recoverable oil and 5 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, and goes on to say initial production after platform and infrastructure implementation could be approximately 75,000 barrels of oil and 300 million cubic feet of gas per day from the KLU anti-clinal feature alone. So pretty stunning structure there. Yes, Senator Wagner. Well,
one thing, Mr. Chairman, in the reserves they're talking about, I haven't talked too much to Mr. Davis, but I think a big portion of that is probably from the sunfish that ARCO discovered years ago and didn't produce because the price dropped down to about $9 a barrel. But that oil is in place. It has been drilled and it has been found. It's going to be difficult to produce, but it's there. So.
Marcia, welcome back.
Chairman Wilikowski, I was able to review this bill and confer with Kevin Banks, Director at Department of Natural Resources, because I believe it will require both the DOR and DNR to work together to administer this particular provision, particular credit. I think the first question we wanted to make sure was abundantly clear that would help DOR is in the first line 6, where it talks about the first to bore a hole, and then later on in, I think, 14 and 15 when we talk about.
So you're on line 6, page 2.
Line 6, okay. Where, again, I just look at it with an administrator's eye. How will I pick who's the first and who's the second and who's the third? So in terms of bore a hole, that either implies that you've spudded the well, begun to drill, or completed it. And in conferring with Director Banks, I think our joint recommendation would be to go with spud date for 2 reasons. One, it certainly does ensure that good quality field practices are being applied to the drilling well, that people aren't taking chances or risks to get their well completed before someone else. Secondly, I believe that the spud date is something that's adequately recorded not only by date but by hour specific time, and to the extent that DOR would need to resolve a competition between 2 drillers as to who, quote, spud first, we would have better evidence of that fact, I think, in terms of all the way down to the minute. We sure don't want to be Solomon and have to, you know, slice something in half here. So that would help us. And I think those were our key concerns. The other concern I'll let Kevin address, and that was the determination of whether a well results in production and paying quantities, because again, being the paranoid tax party. If I was putting myself in the shoes of an explorer and drilling a well and recognizing if that the result of me drilling a successful well was that I was going to have to pay back half of my credit, you know, maybe I have not such a good well, and you know, I'll tell people that and plug it, and then it's way cheaper for me to go drill another well and access the same reserves. So I would like to know that DNR is in a position to do some sort of certification or verification on that particular well, whether it qualifies.
And for the record, I'm Kevin Banks, the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and the expression of the notion is being here is that you drill a well into some horizon that's sub-Cretaceous or our recommendation pre-tertiary. We can get into that in a moment, but the a target that hasn't been discovered, and if the consequence of that drilling, that exploration well, is that the production comes from that zone, why then part of the credit will be paid back. So there are a couple things. Typically, exploration wells are not converted into producers. It's just there is a reason why exploration is, the drilling activities on an exploration well are occasionally different. There may not be the right location when time comes to begin producing for a well in a field after further evaluations are done. So we're going to try to help the sponsor work up some kind of language that has the notion of sustained production from the prospect that in fact was discovered with this well. That's the idea.
Kevin, let me ask you, do you have any public data that you can share with us about what kind of reserves might be found in the subcretaceous zone?
I don't believe we know very much about what is in the subcretaceous. There's really only when we look at what possibly could be would fall under this category, we know that there's been a well drilled in MacArthur River that struck oil at this depth, but I'm not even sure that it's ever been produced.
Chairman Wilikowski, an interesting aspect to this, particularly as it relates to a jackup rig, is that if the first jackup rig that comes into Cook Inlet receives 100% of its costs as a credit, you've essentially achieved the objective of getting a jackup rig into Cook Inlet. Just so folks know, under the current lease expenditure laws or lease expenditure regulations, the cost to mobilize that jackup rig to the state of Alaska are fully includable as a lease expenditure. What we have a limitation on is once that jackup rig is in Alaska, we also allow the deduction of the demobilization of that rig to other parts of Alaska. We do not allow the costs for demobilization as a deduction leaving Alaska. So there's a certain inherent magnetism within Alaska under our tax laws that once the rig is here, it should hopefully be put to work numerous times.
Great. Okay, questions? All right, thank you. I don't see anyone signed up for public testimony. Do we have anyone online? No? Anyone in the audience wanting to testify? Okay, we'll close public testimony. We're going to set the bill aside, and thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Wagner. Interesting idea. Okay, next up we have House Bill 280, Natural Gas Storage and Tax, and Representative Hawker, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Representative Mike Hawker, representing District 32 in South Central Alaska. If it pleases you, I get whatever your desire is here. I can present this bill as briefly or in as much detail as you'd like.
Yeah, we've got about 30 minutes, so I think it's an important bill. It's a pretty comprehensive bill. I know I've had my staff looking at it the last few days. Why don't you go ahead and give us your presentation, and then questions may arise as you go along, and we'll bore down into it as we go along.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I sincerely appreciate the latitude and the opportunity to present in the committee here. House Bill 280 is a direct product of the needs that have become, I think, are very well known. I don't need to go into any further explanation, I believe, for your committee of the needs for additional gas and additional, and most importantly, something we've never had in the Cook Inlet before, and that is a large capacity gas storage to ensure deliverability to retail customers. And Mr. Chairman, I believe you did have a full presentation of the recent Cook Inlet gas issues reports. And sort of within the context of that, House Bill 280 specifically addresses three of the distinct issues that were raised regarding the needs in the Cook Inlet. Those three issues are the need for gas storage in Cook Inlet, storage necessary for utilities to be able to meet peak demands, and storage that proprietary interests, the actual producers themselves, need to manage their own inventories and meet their own deliverability contracts. Secondly, it addresses the need for additional exploration and development for gas in Cook Inlet, and it also addresses some of the issues that were related to the need for long-term supply contracts between producers and utilities, and that specifically addresses the Regulatory Commissions of Alaska's involvement in the process of delivering gas to consumers. And so, Senators, again, I can go through the bill either in sectional on a sequential organization or more on a thematic, and if you don't mind, I'd kind of like to talk about the thematic approach, and I'll cross-reference sections as I do this.
Yeah, I think at some point, and however you feel more comfortable presenting it, I would like to go through section by section, but if you think the better way to do that is sort of thematically, then we're happy to accommodate that.
Well, I'll do my very best to accommodate you. Very briefly, there are sections in the bill, Mr. Chairman. You know, first, the bigger components of the bill in encouraging the development of gas storage facilities. That's a very important section of this bill. It creates the first real regulatory framework we have in the state of Alaska for the development and regulation of gas storage facilities that did not exist before. Specifically there at the end of the day, we're going to provide a volumetric-based development credit, essentially an investment tax credit. Based on certain criteria that a storage facility has to meet. That storage credit, and any investment in storage in the Cook Inlet is necessarily going to increase the gas to consumers. It's part of a supply chain cost. The development credit is intended specifically to be consumer cost relief, and in that we have provisions in the bill that specifically require the development credit, the storage development credit, to be passed through ultimately to consumers. As far as encouraging development and further gas storage, we do ask the Department of Natural Resources to expedite applications, permits, and that sort of thing for the development of these gas storage facilities. It's very important to recognize in this bill that while it does offer this pass-through credit for the development of gas storage facilities, for any entity to avail themselves of those credits, they must also accept RCA regulation. That is an absolute linkage in this bill. Take advantage of the credit available, accept RCA regulation. The bill does protect the ability of individual producers to develop storage for their own purposes. Again, inventory, warehouses, their own warehouses for their own gas that they've developed. Very, very specifically, no credits are available for companies that want to build proprietary storage for their own inventory management purposes. That's not the intent of the legislation. And likewise, the RCA does not have regulatory, as in today, the RCA would not have regulatory authority over those privately owned proprietary interest gas storage facilities. In addressing the need for long-term contracts, additional long-term contracts, and we've had
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Frank.
I appreciate the thematic approach, but maybe you could just sort of, as you, it sounds like you're moving from one section to another now. Or from one theme to another, let me put it that way. Maybe you could just identify the sections that pertain to gas storage credits and those that pertain to the RCA matters.
And Senator, if I was just trying, my theory here was to give the quick thematic without reference to specific sections. That would provide the framework, and then I'll go through the sectional in a sequential manner, which might be the easiest.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Why don't you go through the thematically, and then if you could, let's just walk through the sections, because it is a pretty dense bill and a lot of important things in there. So
very much, sir. And so again, hitting the highlights of what we're going to see in the specific sections. The challenge in establishing these long-term supply contracts, we've had a couple of very significant contracts that were not approved, or applications for long-term contracts that were not approved by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska in the past several years. In working with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and talking with them about what would they need to have perhaps viewed those contracts in a different light and perhaps, you know, approve them, and that they, in hindsight, they appear to have been very good, would have been very good contracts to have approved. The bill asks the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, or directs that now, that when making a decision on a contract application, they not only have to look at the specifics of the contract, but at the consequences of saying no to that contract. They've never had to contemplate the consequences on the consumer in reaching their decisions. And again, that was a provision that we've developed along with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and their legal counsel, who believe it really does, and we've had testimony on the House side, that it really would make a difference in how the Regulatory Commission viewed the requirements of the consumer in making decisions. And then lastly, there are a number of sections in the bill that increase access, and I use that word access for folks, explorers, developers working in the Cook Inlet to existing tax credits. And again, you had an outstanding presentation earlier here of the matrix of credits out there. In this bill, we do not add any new credits outside of the development credit for storage facilities, but we have attempted to increase access to those existing credits, simply make the Cook Inlet a more attractive place for investment capital. If it is the pleasure of the committee, moving towards the specifics of the sectional here, Mr. Chairman, don't mind me, a slight diversion here. I'd like to recognize the people that have worked diligently in putting this bill together with me. This has not been a fly-by-night bill. I've probably done a few of those in my career as well. But in this bill particularly, it was developed over the course of the summer with a great deal of research by Larry Pursley, who is now the federal gas line czar. Here moments ago, and I believe he stepped out. Mr. Roger Marks, who's here, is former senior petroleum economist for the Department of Revenue. Ms. Jan Levy, who's behind me, who is a former oil and gas attorney with the Department of Law of the state, was extensively involved in oil and gas and regulatory litigation matters for those folks. And then, of course, my procedural advisor, Ms. Julie Lucky, who I think we all know here in the building. So I've got a really wonderful team to work with in bringing this forward. So we've tried very hard to make a bill that is as non-confrontational, as non-controversial as could be as possible, but yet do the greatest good for assuring the energy security of the folks that live in South Central Alaska. So running through the bill itself, sir, there is a sectional attached in your package, and I think it's very well and thoroughly written in presenting the bill. And that would be, starting with Section 1, it simply sets out a short title for the bill, and that would be calling it the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, reflecting what the real intent is here, and that is to add some, revitalize the Cook Inlet, make it a more attractive place for oil and gas, and specifically gas exploration, providing for the consumer security. Section 2 is necessary in that this is a volumetric credit as we develop the large capacity gas storage. That means there's a later section here where the gas storage credit is calculated at $1.50 per square foot, or excuse me, $1.50 per thousand square feet of capacity of the storage facility. The Section 2 says that certification and the certifications in this bill shall be done by the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The point of this, and it deviates somewhat from other bills that have been considered, it's not a cost-based credit. The reason for that is that if we do a cost-based credit, we get into the whole issue of auditing costs and what's allowable, what's not allowable, and even in the earlier bill you just discussed, when do the costs begin, when do they end, all those complex regulatory considerations. We believe that we can have a much more efficient system that requires but one certification, and that's operating volumes, something that AOGC has assured us they're very capable of doing, and it eliminates the incredibly complex regulatory tasks that would be involved in a cost-based credit.
I see your question on that.
But of course, Mr. Chairman.
Just on the two numbers that you had selected, one on page 2, line 10, you had selected 500 million cubic feet, and then on line 13, being able to withdraw a minimum of 10 million cubic feet. Any magic to those numbers?
Mr. Chairman, the magic of those numbers is they were the product of a consensus reached by us in discussions with Department of Natural Resources as well as Department of Revenue. Initially, we had were looking at a double the capacity, a bill that would have allowed or paid the credit up to double the capacity, and recognizing that this credit does not flow to the developer. 100% of it flows through to consumers. We were trying to sort of second guess the volume of large capacity storage that will be developed and necessary in Cook Inlet. We again really had twice this much, and there was some concern expressed by Department of, I believe it was Revenue, that we wanted the bill as tightly, as close to what will be the prospective development as possible. So it was an effort to try to stop or mitigate the potential gaming of the system. The idea of the flow-through volumetrics, again, discussed with the department and other knowledgeable folks, indicating, again, we don't want to be giving credits to somebody building a storage facility that cannot deliver sufficient gas to meet our peak demands. And again, it was, somewhat of a judgmental call, and something that, you know, perhaps that if we see any formal announcement of a, you know, real projects that we could benchmark this and not just be using hypothetical projects, I'll be very honest, sir, we might want to consider expanding the size of those credits, but it's also something we could do in a subsequent legislative session when we have real projects on the deck and not hypotheticals. So again, we're looking at protecting the state with those limits.
And is 10 million what is projected we would, Cook Inlet would need on a very cold day in January?
Well, if you, that's the minimum amount, and that's a fairly low number, but it's not, we look at those peaking requirements. I mean, we hit 400 million cubic feet a day demanded in the coldest winter days. Again, the idea of these storage facilities is to meet the peaking demands, not the sustained delivery.
That's fair.
The bill also, we get to section, again, that same section 2 includes notification requirements, and that is that we also say that if you cease using a storage facility within the first 10 years, we've got a recovery recapture provision on any credits provided that would have to then be refunded by the developer back to the state of Alaska, and that would also be AOGCC being having to be notified on those sort of cessations. Section 3 is the urgency provision. It's a provision that we are directing as part of its fundamental duties to the director of the Department of Natural Resources is as reasonably possible provide priority and expedite applications, permits, and the type of ministerial work required to get a facility underway. As was demonstrated, well proven in the presentation you had earlier of the needs in Cook Inlet, time is of the essence. And this is an urgency provision directing the DNR to recognize that it is a priority and we must need to move these things forward. Section 4 is a provision. This is the provision that protects the warehousing facilities, proprietary facilities, facilities that a producer would use simply to manage their own inventory. Not an open access facility, not a facility owned by a utility who's buying gas and storing it for ultimate consumer delivery. And here, this one provides that the Department of Natural Resources shall not deny a storage lease specifically and solely, and I even got the word in it, it is solely because it is being used as proprietary storage. And I'd be very honest with you, my good friend Kevin Banks and I have had quite a discussion on this issue. I think he has a slightly different view than I have bringing you the bill forward, but I sincerely believe the provisions in the bill are truly in the best interest of the state of Alaska. And, we could, if you wish to go into that, certainly we can address that later, but I would recommend that.
Sorry, Senator French.
Yeah, we may as well just do a little bit of it now. I don't want to hold up the overview, but maybe just a referencing question, something I can think about, is whether this has happened. Has the director denied permits to producers for their storage wells?
What I would, through the chair, Representative French, in my conversations with industry players and with Mr. Banks in his role, you know, it had been brought to my attention that the policy taken by the DNR would be that they would not permit storage facilities that were other than an open access facility. And with very good, they have the, you know, again, I don't, as presented to me in my conversations with Mr. Banks, you know, the concern was we do need more storage capacity right now. Smaller producers themselves may not have the financial wherewithal to build their own storage. And I would say until we had a very active, vibrant third-party storage facility, the agency had concluded that it was best to make all future storage facilities open access. Where that crossed my line of a little too much government interference and really not recognizing the reality that I see in the inlet. The producers certainly need to manage their own inventory, the product they're bringing out to meet their deliverability requirements. It's warehousing. We look at, for example, Chevron had the substantial warehousing capability over the Drift River Terminal facility that just happened to sit at the foot of a volcano. The volcano got a little cranky, so that storage facility is now taken completely offline from a standpoint of petroleum. It's oil, not gas here. But they, without having that storage, it's now interfering with their ability to, it has the potential of interfering with their ability to maximize and sustain an ongoing production because they don't have a warehouse to put their own product in. So back, same thing with gas, is that if the company does not have an ability to bring gas up, have a warehouse to store it in until you move it off to market, we are encouraging them to shut in gas to not maximize production. The practicality of the inlet is such that we're going to see, there is no doubt in my mind, in a very short time, we're going to see proposals for a very large, open-access, third-party-owned project. So again, this bill anticipates that, providing benefits and credits to the open access facility, denying all benefits to someone who simply wants to manage their own inventory.
Thank you.
And we'll have a robust debate on that section.
And I thank you very kindly, and I would ask you to remember that your colleagues in the legislature are probably right on that question, sir.
But I have some of them or all of them?
Which colleagues?
Thank you. Back in moving through the sectional requirements again, I think we were up to now section 5, and this is one again. It's one of the incentive clauses for the development of open access third-party storage or storage owned by a utility that would be used to provide gas deliverability security to citizens, is that if a facility is constructed on state land leases, that the lease fees or rents are to be waived for the first 10 years of that facility's operations. Again, incentive to move the facility online, and most importantly, it would have to be, those costs again are passed on to the consumer. It's again minimizing the consumer impact of what is going to likely be substantial as we look at bringing the necessary storage facilities online. There's also technical provisions in there talking about how the facilities would work, and this gets into the regulatory framework of gas that we've not had. And if you think of a gas storage facility as an underground, it's a big underground, it's a nearly depleted gas well itself that you're now recharging with another gas well that's producing and active, so that when you want a lot of gas, you can pull the gas out of both wells at the same time. We're providing regulatory clarity here for developers, and we're saying, because we know that there's going to be some residual gas left in the bottom of that the new storage well, and likewise there has to be some gas down there to maintain enough pressure to push back out what you're putting in as inventory. And this bill creates that regulatory framework and essentially provides for these new storage facilities a last in, first out inventory accounting. And that meaning that the last gas pumped into it is the first gas that comes out. And that is relevant in that we, the last gas in the bottom of that well is certain has not ever been produced, and the producer would ultimately, when it is produced, there will be a liability and obligation to pay production taxes. Again, we're saying that when you pump the gas down, I don't care which exact molecule comes back out, that it's last in, first out accounting, so that we don't have to worry about production taxes until someone produces more from a storage facility than they've ever pumped into it. Now, Section 6 was the RCA provisions, as we discussed earlier, when a gas supply contract is being considered, that for the first time they really need to think about the consequences on the consumer in addition to their other evaluative criteria. And another point we've mentioned stipulated here is that a portfolio representing a diversified terms of gas supply contracts is a good thing. So not saying that because something has either never been done or because it we don't need to be looking for what has already been done in the past, but that we think it's a very good thing for a utility to have gas supply contracts under a variety of terms and conditions to, again, to sort of mitigate, we call it a concentration of risk, should there be some parameter change that would affect the one style of supply contract. Note, and certainly the testimony is available if you would like it to be arranged, but we've had a very supportive testimony for this provision in previous committees. Section 7 is one of those that specifically requires that if a utility is storing gas, that the cost of that gas storage, as it ultimately is brought into the rate-making process, it is that the financial benefits of any tax credits or lease exemptions provided in this legislation directly flow through to the consumer. I mean, as clearly as we can possibly state, these gas storage credits do not accrue to the benefit of the developer. They accrue totally to the benefit of the ultimate consumer. Side recognizing again, and there are no credits, no benefits to a proprietary storage development. We also, a clarity point that was brought to us in our ongoing conversations with the smart people at the Department of Revenue and Department of Natural Resources, reminded us that a potential loophole in the bill, and that would be that it could be argued that if you constructed a large natural gas pipeline, that since it's a vessel capable of storing gas, it might be, or someone might argue that it would fall under the parameters of this legislation, which was not at all intended. So we're making it very clear that a natural gas storage facility that's part of a regulated natural gas pipeline is not also regulated by the utility under the provisions of this bill. So we're, again, clarifying, segregating those regulatory authorities. The Section 9 gets into the specifics that the RCA does have jurisdiction over gas storage services provided for gas that is owned by a regulated utility. And that's, again, we're looking at, there's a couple of levels of storage and regulation we've got to be sure we cover. And in this case, this is gas that would be purchased on the market by a utility who is, and the utility itself has developed the gas storage facility that's regulated. Other provisions talk about how a third-party facility that provides services to a public utility is also regulated. So we've got to get all the permutations covered.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you're referring, Representative Hawker, to the definition on page 8, lines 18 and 19.
Through the chair, Representative French, that line, is that the addition of a Section G?
Yes.
And that one is the catch-all, but that catches someone that's in a third-party business providing the actual service to This is defining what a public utility is, and yes, that is saying that capacity, an entity of business furnishing natural gas storage to the public, it is right. Absolutely regular, which catches the utilities.
This is the definition that grabs your third-party storage well and puts it under the jurisdiction of the RCA. Is that right? I'm just wanting to make sure.
Oh gosh, and I want to make my counsel behind me because we got both in here, and I want to be sure I get the right pieces. my counselor has abandoned me.
You just got one of these from
Mr. Marks. Heads nodding yes.
So, Representative, excuse me, sir, Senator Wilkowski, chair to Senator French, I have been assured by my legal counsel in this bill that your statement is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Getting Section 10 is the clarifying what is actually part of the gas storage facilities. And again, we're making sure that it's the facility itself and not a lot of ancillary components. And this is Section 10 is where we pick up the RCA regulation of gas storage facilities to operate it primarily or exclusively for third-party customers. So here we're picking up the third-party customer coverage.
Can I ask you a question on this? Could the definition of natural gas storage facility include the LNG plant in Nikiski?
The Representative Wilkowski, excuse me, sir, Senator Wilkowski, Mr. Chair, as we have defined the ability for someone to get a credit under this bill, again, it had to be delivering gas to consumers. So as an export plant and facility, was not contemplated for the benefits.
So I know, on very cold winter days, isn't there a provision where they release some of their gas back? Or
Senator Wilkowski, anecdotally, I am aware that when the peak demand of coldest days has occurred in South Central Alaska in the past couple of winters, and it wouldn't have been this winter, but the previous couple of winters, the ConocoPhillips, who owns and operates that facility, actually diverted gas that they had committed to the export to a customers overseas and diverted that into the supply chain for consumers. As I understand it anecdotally, that is an action that was voluntary on their part and is not part of any sort of a contractual agreement, as their contractual agreement was with their overseas customer. And essentially the way gas, when you think about gas storage, or excuse me, gas delivery trains, when that boat leaves, there's no way to ever make it up. So with their good friends' relationship with their consumers in Asia has allowed, I find there's folks in Japan that said, okay, you've short shipped to us, short delivered to us, but they've not called default on those contracts, recognizing the needs of the state of Alaska. I think another point here we had on Section 11, making sure that this is public information, names of taxpayers and amounts of credit are made as public information, and that's necessary that the information is available to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska in their duties.
Representative Hawker, I'm going to we're about halfway through. We had extended for another 30 minutes. Would this be a good place to stop? I don't know that we're going to get done very on this bill quickly. We've got another 9 or 10 pages. Would this be a good place to stop and pick up at a future hearing?
It certainly would be, sir. The next section, we go into the technical components of the credit and the requirements of a basin in order to meet the credit. So it'd be a very excellent place to stop the conversation, sir.
Great. Final questions from the committee before we break? Okay. I want to thank everyone for staying late. And Representative Hawker, thank you. And we look forward to bringing this up in the very near future.
Thank you very kindly, Mr. Chairman. And I look forward to being back with you in the very near future.
With that, we're adjourned.